Shrink Wrap Radio number 886. David Borkenhagen, PhD on time, space, and Jungian architecture.
And now it's time for Dr. Dave and Shrink Wrap Radio.
You're on the couch again with Dr. Dave. And Shrink Wrap Radio is playing on again. Yeah. It's all in your head. It's all in your head. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio. Shrink Wrap Radio.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
Once again, my London associate and blogger, Isabella Clark, steps in to conduct another interview. I really treasure Issy, and I hope you do too. She is an Oxford grad and a professional broadcaster. She reads widely in areas I don't cover, and consequently, she brings us high-quality guests I would not have known about. Now here's Issy with her latest find.
It's Issy Clark here, given an opportunity to do an interview by the ever-generous Dr. Dave. And my interviewee is David Borkenhagen. He's a postdoctoral scholar at Matheson Center for Mental Health Research and Education at the University of Calgary in Canada. I came across his work on the online magazine Psyche, and when I got in touch with David, he was generous enough to agree to do an interview. So here's the interview. David Borkenhagen, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you for having me.
I came across you with an article, particularly one that you had written on Psyche, but on the sister journal, Eon, I saw that there were two others, which actually I'd read in the past. But when I read the one on Psyche, I thought, oh, David would be a really interesting guest for us to have on Shrink Wrap Radio. So thank you for being willing to spend the time. And first of all, if you could just introduce yourself, give us a bit of background. How come you ended up studying the work that you're studying and particularly looking at Carl Jung?
Yeah, for sure. Thanks so much for having me. I just graduated from my PhD in cognitive neuroscience from the University of Waterloo. I studied under the supervision of Dr. Colin Ellard at the Urban Realities Lab. So what we're interested in is psychological, emotional, behavioral responses to the built environment. So that includes architecture and communities. I think predominantly a lot of the research has focused on emotional responses to buildings, emotional responses to streetscapes, whether they make us feel threatened or whether they make us feel maybe embraced or accommodated. But I think that there was increasingly sort of more work in the area of how space is important in general for different types of cognition. And that got me thinking about how experiences with space in the world, including spaces that are designed, so architectural spaces, can actually be used for a model for different types of abstract thought. So that's a very sort of high level introduction to some of the research and work that I'm doing. And it turns out that there had actually been a bunch of theorizing on this topic by other academics and scholars, Carl Jung being one of them.
That's so interesting. When you were a kid, did you imagine that this would be the area that you were studying?
I think that it is inspired by my own personal experiences. In different ways. So I grew up in Calgary, Canada, which Alberta, it's in the province of Alberta, and we call Alberta the Texas of Canada. So when I was growing up, it was kind of a socially conservative place. And a lot of the It's interesting because even though I lived in the same city as my peers, I grew up in the same city as my peers, my experience felt different. And it kind of manifested as a different terms of interaction with the city. The city didn't feel like it sort of responded to my needs or responded to sort of my desires. So that sort of led me to become critical, not only about urban environments, but also about subjectivity. So what is it about me? What is it about my psychology that might be different, that might be requiring me to have different expectations of the city? And what is it about the city that is not reciprocating those sort of desires? And so those were some maybe early experiences when I was young that certainly led me down the path of studying psychology, but also led me to become interested in cities and architecture and see them as sort of mechanisms that could be used to liberate or emancipate or have some really profound effect on my sense of self. And this happens to be a story that I think a lot of other people experience too. I know that in the UK, if you're a creative person, there's sort of only one place you can go, and that's London. I don't know if that's still the case, but certainly a lot of sort of the origin stories of a lot of cultural workers in the UK is that they grew up in some other small, boring town, and then they come to the big city and they just unlock new dimensions of their personalities. And so it seems to be kind of a consistent trope that I think a lot of people are familiar with. And I suppose I wanted to be more objective and more scientific about it and understand it from the perspective of research psychology.
That is so interesting, and I love that idea of you walking around as a young person and seeing the built environment as, as something with which you were out of kilter, and actually being able to articulate that to yourself in some way, I think is wonderful. Well, I want to lead up to the article that you wrote for Psyche about Jung and architecture, and on the way to talk about metaphors and octopuses and social space as we've started here. But perhaps a good place to start is with the idea, and I think it's now been given some scientific backing through experiments that our thinking is tied to our bodies and to movement. So we actually, our thought processes are kind of like determined by our embodiment, and those ideas expressed in Metaphors We Live By, the seminal work of George Lakoff and Mark Johnson. So I was hoping that you could kind of give us a bit of a précis of what that that sort of hypothesis is.
Sure, yeah. So traditional cognitive science and psychology predating the 1960s, let's say, approached the mind as if it were disembodied from the body, as if it were more akin to a computing device, a computer. And it was the computer metaphor that dominated research psychology and cognitive science for several decades. However, increasingly, and in part sort of inspired by George Lakoff and Mark Johnson's work, we came to notice how common different, very simplistic embodied terms appeared in our descriptions of thought. So, for example, if I present to you the concept of an idea is a element of the mind. It's not an element of the world. So it's something that can only exist in my mind. It can exist in your mind. It's not something that exists in the world until we sort of bring it to language or bring it to words. But what's interesting about when we talk about ideas is that we use a lot of embodied terms to talk about their dynamics or their dimensions. So, for example, I can say something like, I pull the idea apart, or I can say, I can see this idea clearly, or I can say, I can see through that idea, or I can say, oh, we are tossing this idea around. So, in all of those expressions, I'm using very simple embodied terms, tossing, seeing, pulling. to describe my relationship with something that doesn't actually exist in the real world. It doesn't actually, an idea doesn't actually exist in the real world. It's still sort of a matter of psychology, a matter of the mind. So that alone, that terminology, which we deploy so readily and we deploy it with such ease, it wasn't really acknowledged by cognitive scientists and research psychologists that we use all these embodied terms in different types of abstract thinking until George Lakoff and Mark Johnson published Metaphors We Live By, along with a bunch of other work that occurred in the 1980s, which was making note of the fact that these embodied terminologies occur in all sorts of types of abstract thinking, and that they really do provide a sort of structure to talk about abstract concepts. So another one, for example, is the concept of time. So time is very abstract, and a lot of research from research psychology and research in metaphors is demonstrating that in order for humans to make sense of this abstract concept of time, we're using a much more simple sort of spatial coordinate system that's grounded in the physics of space and the physics of our body to be able to make sense of the abstract concept of time and communicate the abstract concept of time to other people.
Yes, that I did find that particularly interesting. Especially there was one example that you cited in the piece about time, where you say is explain that we can switch between the ego moving, so say we're approaching the weekend, and time moving by saying the weekend's approaching. And you say that in different experiments you can prime people to see time in different ways. Can you explain that a little bit?
So these metaphors that we use for time, they aren't necessarily fixed, and they're not necessarily innate. So the example that you just brought up was when you're conceptualizing time on the front back axis with the future is in front of you and the past is behind you. So as a starting point, that metaphor, it kind of makes sense from this embodied perspective because we are more capable of interacting with objects that are in front of us. From a physical standpoint, compared to interacting with objects that are behind us. And that's kind of a useful way to think about time as well, in general. And I kind of critique this idea in the essay, but in general, you can say that, well, we certainly have a better ability to act, it seems, on the future events that are to come, compared to acting on events that are in the past that we can no longer access. So that sort of seems like a logical grounding of the abstract concept of time. However, you still have to confront with the fact that time moves. And so there's two primary metaphors for reckoning with the movement of time, and that is either you are an individual that's moving through space, so this is called the ego moving metaphor, or you're in a stationary position and time is flowing through you, kind of like a river, as if you were sitting in a river and time were a river that's flowing. So both of these dynamics for time would work. They create a language that makes sense. So in both of those expressions that you mentioned to me, both of those statements, I can make sense of the physics that you're mentioning in those statements. But now you asked about switching between the two. So yes, the answer is yes. You can switch between the two quite flexibly, and it can be something that occurs just based on embodied experiences. So one of the studies that I cited in the article was a study where they asked an ambiguous question about an upcoming event, and the question could have been answered from a ego-moving perspective or from a time-moving perspective. But what they did was they asked this question to people in a lunch line, and what they found was that people who were at the front of the lunch line, participants who were at the front of the queue, who had been moving for a longer amount of time, more readily adopted the ego moving metaphor for time in comparison to those at the back of the line who knew that they were just about to wait, who hadn't moved significantly. They were more likely to adopt the time moving metaphor. So this is just a small example of how our experiences with space, our embodied experiences with space, can have these sort of consequential effects on how we're construing something that you think is not related to space, which is time, and how you're conceptualizing the movement of time. So it's a pretty cool finding. It's really interesting because in traditional cognitive science and experimental psychology paradigms, we often don't integrate movement. We don't integrate the body, right? Because in these experiments, we really have to control for all types of potential confounds. And so these types of experiments are actually trying to manipulate the body in space, move it around in space, and try to find effects on cognition.
That is so interesting. And although it's using or explaining a different process, it reminds me of, I can't remember whether it was, it was just a sort of like fun thing that I remember my mother saying to me, and, you know, imagine running, imagine jumping, imagine skipping, now imagine, you know, all of these things. And now a piece of furniture, and you would imagine a bed or a chair or something that you could rest on, because you'd been imagining so intensely all these high energy pursuits. And so, I mean, it is interesting how just the way that you think about something can kind of like change how you feel and your decision making. And in the same way, the way that you're actually moving can change the way that you think. So
exactly.
There's a sort of like bi-directional inference going on there.
Exactly. Yeah.
And culturally, you cite in the article, and I remember reading this before, that there are some Indigenous communities for whom the future is not, in fact, imagined as in front of the person, the individual, but is perceived as behind, which seems very different to us.
That's correct. So this is. It's quite astounding to hear about this. So in the Aymara language, actually, which is spoken in Peru, so the past is described as the time before my eyes. They have a word, and it's referencing the space that's before, right in front of them. So that's the spatial descriptor for the space that's right in front of them. That's the same word that they use for the past, right? They call tomorrow. The word that they have for tomorrow is the day at my back, right?
Yeah.
So the reason, the rationale for those metaphors, according to anthropologists who have studied this culture, is that they say that it's the past events that are known, past events are visible, and those are the ones that can be discussed. And this is true when you think about it. Whereas the future is unknown, so they put the future in the not visible space of the body. Yeah. And so this is just a simple example. This is Aymara in Peru, a simple example of how our metaphors for time are certainly not innate. So this idea that the future is always in front of us, it's not innate. There are other cultures around the world that have different metaphors for time. And also, you can think about the sort of decision-making consequences or the inferential consequences of structuring time, schematizing time, the way that Aymara do. So I sort of expand on this a little bit in the essay, but you could imagine how it could have positive benefits for talking about past events, right? Because the Aymara are more likely to sort of conceptualize them as the things that we can see, whereas the future is the thing that's unknown. So I don't know if there's been a study on the relationship of that culture to the past, but I think it'd be reasonable to predict that culture, individuals from that culture would have a better time, better ease, more fluid, better ease at talking about the past in comparison to Western cultures that use a different metaphor for time.
I do think that's interesting. And when you started were saying the idea of tomorrow as being, you know, behind my back, I was thinking there's a line in a poem by Andrew Marvell to his coy mistress, which refers to time's winged chariot. And you have the idea of, I mean, it suddenly struck me that time's winged chariot, it's almost like it's kind of like chasing you down. So it's almost like the future is there, you know, kind of like chasing you down, and you're trying to, in a way, outrun it. And I mean, I guess in a lot of ways, that's what, you know, a lot of us are trying to do with sort of like looking younger, feeling younger, staying younger. We're trying to run away from the
Run
time
away from
that's
time, yeah.
chasing us. Yeah.
Right. And there was another study that I cite at the end of the article where I talk about patients who are in end-of-life care. And these individuals in end-of-life care, it's reported that they have they're more likely to adopt the time moving metaphor as opposed to the ego moving metaphor because they're in end-of-life care, and also oftentimes they have the if they might be incapacitated, they might be unable to sort of enact their body in the same way that they had previously had. So they're more likely to adopt these this time moving perspective. But what also seems to co-occur along with the adoption of this time moving perspective is a better ability to receive the care of others. So here's a sort of corollary potential consequence of shifting your conceptualization of your relationship with the movement of time could also affect, or it seems to be correlated with an equal ability to have a greater acceptance of the love and care of other people.
That's interesting. That is interesting. And you sort of further suggest you use the idea of the octopus as a creature who is very differently embodied from us, and for whom, you know, space is, you know, is every goes in every direction. It hasn't just got this sort of like, you know, forward back conception, but the octopus can move every way and change its bodily form. And you suggest that that kind of fluidity of thought, you know, could reap benefits in terms of offering a fluidity of the fluidity of the body could offer benefits in terms of a fluidity of thinking.
And truly, I'm not able to make any claims of confidence about how the octopus thinks, but we can use its sort of movement as a model or as a conceptual tool to think about how we can unrestrict and free some of our own metaphors for our relationship with time. And I want to be clear too, sometimes it's better just to say our relationship with memory and our relationship with future thinking. Clearly, I'm not talking about literal time travel, but our relationship to our sort of structure of historic events versus future thinking events versus seeing them all as part of a timeline. Our relationship with how we're structuring these events in our minds. So to use this sort of octopus metaphor is kind of a potent conceptual tool for humans, right?
Let's move on to the metaphors of space used in the social
Sure.
area, because a social arena, like close friends or a person who appears distant. And you write, and this leads to a radical possibility. If we make sense of our friendships, acquaintances, colleagues, families, and societies through spatial relationships, could architectural concepts, the intentional design of space, become tools for creating new metaphors for social and political thought? And I found that really exciting. What are you getting at there?
I think that that statement was sort of a consequence of, well, two things. First of all, it's sort of built off of these new empirical findings that space plays a prominent role in structuring social cognition, so how we think about other people. Spatial terminology is everywhere. And also, there's good evidence to indicate that we're truly thinking about these other people in those spatial terms. We're representing them in space, in our minds, and that those terms are sort of indications. They're not just idiosyncratic or arbitrary or figurative uses of language. They really are indications of how we're representing some of those other people in our mind. And I suppose I wrote this piece after I wrote the Octopus Time piece. And when I was writing the time piece, it sort of became apparent that these metaphorical spaces that we're applying to time are not innate. They're actually arbitrary and they're culturally conditioned. And so could it be the same for these spatial dimensions that we're applying to social cognition? And I sort of investigated that idea a bit further. And one of the things that I came upon was the fact that spatial and architectural metaphors feature really prominently in social justice movements. So, what is a social justice movement? Well, a social justice movement is a movement that is attempting to change the social structure in some way. So, to do that, you need to sort of chart new territory somehow. You need to describe it and you need to communicate it to other people. And what you find is when you look at these movements, there's oftentimes a spatial or architectural metaphor that becomes kind of a slogan of a movement. So, for example, in 1929, Virginia Woolf wrote her famous feminist essay, A Room of One's Own. So, certainly, she's talking literally in literal terms. Not very many women at that time had the means to purchase sort of a room of their own and house themselves in that way. But from a metaphorical perspective, that metaphor is really potent because that essay is all about the right women have to intellectual agency. And so to cast that sort of social desire in architectural and spatial terms gives it a foundation that then becomes something more tangible and something more concrete that other people who, men, for example, at that time could sort of understand from this sort of objective physical perspective, right? So that is an example of using an architectural or spatial metaphor to chart a new type of social thinking. And you see it still today. LGBTQ movement had come out of the closet. So again, the spatial architectural metaphor. Today, the feminist movement uses break the glass ceiling, a spatial architectural metaphor. So again, these are to their purpose is to chart new types of social thought, right? So they are spatial architectural metaphors, but their intention is for social thought. So those are a couple examples of charting new geographies.
And I'm thinking as you talk about the use of different spatial arrangements in theatre, whether you have something in the round or you have something or you have the players using the aisles in the theatre, or the differences in a very sort of like formal setting where it's, just stalls. And the different ways in which that leads us to interact with the play. And it also leads me to think about things like the agora, the idea of having that sort of like physical meeting place where and a place where it's a kind of like flat place and everyone is in the same function in comparison to, and it's something that you sort of point out and is very obvious in the British government, the left and right within the sort of parliamentary houses. So all of those different spatial arrangements not only arise through often contingent reasons, but they perpetuate it as well, can't they?
And that's a great sort of what you mentioned about you mentioned the left-right political spectrum a little bit there, and that is a great example to talk about because in modern political discourse, we use the terms left and right, left of the political spectrum, right of the political spectrum. Almost one every 10 words, it seems. If you're talking about a political topic, you'll mention if this person is, on the left or the right, if this idea is on the left or the right. And we deploy that terminology and we deploy that spatial thinking so quickly and so readily and so fluidly. But if you actually asked people where that comes from, very few would be able to tell you the origin story of the left-right political spectrum. And it is in fact in an architectural condition. It's in fact in a sort of arbitrary placement of people in space. So in 1789, during the French Revolution, when the in the early formulations of the French government, it just so happened that the royalists, the traditionalists who wanted to keep the monarchy in power in France, they sat on the right side of the king, and the Jacobins who wanted more social liberties, they sat on the left side of the king in the National Assembly, which is where they were formulating some of the first legislation for modern democracy in France after the French Revolution. And from that seating arrangement, the people in that room started to, instead of referring to the Jacobins or the royalists, they could refer to the left and the right, the people on the left and the people on the right. And that just that spatial arrangement, so instead of naming the ideas, they could just name a space. And the ideas, the space became sort of a metaphor for the ideas or synonymous for the ideas. And the fact that that then sort of lifted out of physical space and into cultural discourse, political discourse, and now almost only exists in our minds, right? So it's no longer the case that the left side of the political spectrum has to sit on the left side of parliamentary buildings or anything like that. They do certainly sit together, but they could be sitting on either side of the room. So now this spatialization of social concepts is predominantly one that's just a mental representation, albeit one that's very robust across culture and across political discourse, but it has its original founding in a spatial architectural organization. I think it really goes to show the power of spatial arrangement of ideas initially and how they can have really consequential effects on how we mentally represent those ideas. And we're now hundreds of years later, 200 years later, and we still use this left-right political spectrum.
And how interesting it would have been had there been a north, south, east, west rather than this kind of dichotomy between left and right. It maybe we'd be a little more flourishing now. But this kind of this idea of architecture and thought leads us nicely to the Jung piece. And in the article, you talk about three houses. There's a dream house and then two real houses. Could you introduce us to those three houses, please?
Yeah, absolutely. So it is a really interesting story that I came upon. I didn't know this about Carl Jung until I was doing a little bit more reading. I suppose his most well-known house is probably his dream house. I think most people are familiar with the dream story, which is that he was on a train in the United States with Sigmund Freud, giving a tour, going to some universities and giving some lectures. And he had a dream while he was on this train. And in the dream, he found himself in a house and he felt that it was his house. And like most houses, the salon, so the front, the first floor, was a nice floor. Had nice paintings, nice furniture. It looked good. It was something that, he felt comfortable other people seeing. It was a good facade, you could say. Then at the back of this first floor, he found a stairwell. And as an inquisitive person, he explored it, and this went to a cellar below. And this cellar was different. So it looked medieval. Everything was much older, red brick, that kind of thing. He then found another cellar below that, another stairwell, and he descended again. And here on this level, everything looked Roman. So again, he's sort of descending, he's going through history almost as he's descending these levels. He finds another stairwell and it goes down even deeper. So he finds a floor that's all Greek. It's Greek architecture, old, right? And then again, he finds a fourth floor, fourth story, and he goes down even lower and he finds sort of an archaic space. It looked prehistoric. There was pottery, old pottery, skulls, bones, dust everywhere. And then he awoke. So to be clear, this is a dream. This is a dream. But from that dream, and specifically the lowest floor, he was able to generate his idea of the collective unconscious. And this is really what Carl Jung is known for, I think predominantly, is his idea of the collective unconscious, which is the idea that there is a sort of foundational level of thought, foundational level of constructs, of ideas, of archetypes, of myths that exist between all humans across all cultures. And this idea was really profound for Jung and also for cultural theory and even in psychoanalysis as well. So it led to him writing about almost exclusively about this idea for the rest of his life in different forms. It was really generative. But it all came to him in this dream of a piece of architecture. And it's interesting to think about how architecture is sort of a physical, it's something that it can exist in the world. But what Jung was doing was that he was using it as a model, and he was analogizing, or a metaphor, analogizing. So he has this one thing and he's analogizing to that being the structure of the psyche, of the human psyche, where we have this sort of ego consciousness, this front-facing facade. We have different historical levels upon which our ego consciousness is built, the knowledge from our ego consciousness is built. So we have, the Roman knowledge, the Greek knowledge, the medieval knowledge, and then below that we have this collective unconscious. So that structure of architecture worked so well for Carl Jung to develop this idea. And it's a really cool story. I will say though that the collective unconscious, it's not a topic that we study necessarily in experimental psychology or in cognitive science. Certainly, it's a meaningful concept from a sort of cultural studies perspective, or from a sociological perspective, because it has had a big influence on culture. It isn't quite a scientific concept, but that doesn't mean that it hasn't had a big effect on culture. And it's really interesting to think about how that all came from this architectural dream.
And didn't you say in the article that that after having had this dream, he would sort of go back into the dream house and explore it in his ruminations?
Yes, so he would. And so he recognized that there was more to his personality than this sort of front-facing formality, the ego consciousness that he presented to the world. So at the same time that he had this dream, he had just built a house near Zurich in a town called Küsnacht. And this house was very formal, very analytical. It had everything you would need for a working professional who's a family man. He had his family there. He would host his clients there. Very sort of right angles, a very nice place. But he, following this dream and following subsequent writings, he began to have a closer relationship with his unconscious mind. And he would sort of induce these active imaginations, these sort of dissociative episodes, where he would really try to distance himself from his ego consciousness and explore the myths, the archetypes, the symbols that were revealed to him in his unconscious mind. So for him, that actually meant building a whole nother house, even further down the shores of Lake Zurich, at about as far as you can go from the city, in a town called Bollingen. So that's when he started to create his third house.
That is so wonderful. And I mean, his third house just sounds like it just sounds like a sort of magic fantasy place with, that you could. Is it open to the public now? Is it like a museum? Or...
So it's not a museum. So his house in Küsnacht is a museum. You can visit it, but his, or you can get tours of it. His house in Bollingen is still owned by his family estate,
Oh.
but you can't enter it. So it's there. It's still standing. As far as I'm aware, you can't enter it.
I'm meant to be doing presenting at a sort of conference thing in Austria in September, and I wanted to go by rail, and to get from here in the UK to us to Vienna, Zurich would be a stop-off point. So I suddenly thought I could stop in Zurich for a couple of days. Well, I can see one of his houses, but I can't see the one that I'd really like to see. This conversation reminds me a little of memory palaces as well, and another way in which architecture is used to sort of to as a well in a rather different way, but to support cognition. So people would imagine a very intricate house, and then the things that they had to remember, they would imagine those facts or information in particular places through the house. And I believe isn't I people have used that for, the great memory tests, but I think maybe people used it in more beneficial ways, maybe to remember poetry. I can't remember. I can't remember, but
Certainly, no. So there's something called the method of loci, the method of loci. So it's called a mnemonic device, which is a memory tool. And it's a way to remember large sequences of information is what you can do. And this has been shown experimentally to have a memory benefit, is that you can spatialize it in a mental space. And so the idea is that as you move, you're using sort of mental space to your advantage. As you move through the mental space, your movement and your occupation of those different mental spaces serves as a prompt or a trigger to whatever memories you put in those places. And so this is an effective mnemonic device. Like it works. You can remember if you have a script, let's say, or something that you're trying to remember, you can partition it sort of mentally in different, you can use mental space to your advantage
I'd forget where
to,
I'd put it.
oh yeah, but that's actually, and here we start sort of interfacing with metaphors, spatial metaphors that actually occur common in therapeutic contexts. So for example, compartmentalization, or walling something off, right? Or pulling the rug out, right? So these are all sort of almost domestic metaphors of space that seem to, or you've shut the door out, or you're shuttered, right? These are all sort of these domestic conditions, and they seem to occur really frequently in therapeutic contexts when we're speaking about our relationship to our past memories, maybe past traumas, past experiences. So I think that there's some valid work that could occur in that space. I'm not familiar of that experimental work yet, but it would be looking at how approaching the psyche from the perspective of an architectural space, an architectural space that has the physics, the same physics of architecture, could restrict or benefit different clients and therapeutic processes.
Yeah, I think in hypnotherapy, when I had a course of hypnotherapy one time, that did involve a lot of architectural spaces. So there would be sort of, I mean, some of it was things like You're in a room where there are three different taps, and some of these taps won't switch on, and some of them are flowing. Can you tell me, which tap is, so there would be things like that, but also a place where you feel particularly safe, and suddenly there's a box in your hand, and what's in that box? And I think that, it does appear that our minds are maybe very inspired to open themselves up to the kind of narrative that comes through metaphor and story in a way that in a way that they might not always be to direct questioning.
Yeah, absolutely. And also casting the psyche. So the psyche and ideas of trauma and ideas of the self, these are all really complex constructs, right? But casting them in spatial and architectural terms, that makes them a bit more manageable. You can interact with space in a way that, I can't just say, open up or tell me all about your trauma, but I can say, let's walk through a series of doors where at the furthest door is your most, sacred memory or something like that. So that makes them, by casting them in these sort of spatial architectural terms, that makes them interactable in one way, interactable in a physical. What's interesting though is that so predominantly we've been using imagination, right, to facilitate mental imagery, to facilitate these types of therapeutic processes, such as the one that you described. But I have colleagues, I know people who are working right now in virtual reality to instantiate these metaphors in a more sort of immersive and real, I mean, virtually real space, and then enact these sort of therapeutic processes, whatever that they need, these embodied therapeutic processes through a virtual reality context, right?
So
But there's still, yeah.
is that just in research stages at the moment? Is it in
Yes.
test, is it is there any testing of that going on, or is it purely in the research stage?
Certainly, there have been experiments. Certainly, there have been experiments on variables like confidence. Confidence. So there was some work on embodied cognition, embodied effects on, yeah, different types of variables. Confidence is one of them, let's say. So that's not a clinical variable. So I don't know how much success these types of research projects have been on something like clinical depression. I'm not sure, and I'm not sure if it's at that stage. But there's been a lot of interest on this front. The problem, though, is that as soon as you start trying to systematically manipulate the body and embodied experiences, there are a lot of confounds because everybody's body is different. People have different capabilities with their bodies. So it's very difficult to maybe find the perfect sort of manipulation, the perfect sort of systematic manipulation that would work for everybody. But it's definitely seems to be the type of therapy that works for some people, if you can get maybe the conditions correct. Yeah, but this is an emerging field of research for sure.
That's so interesting. So interesting. I imagine, I think Dr. Dave might be very interested in finding out more about that kind of research as well. Something that I remembered, maybe I was walking through one of my lesser known corridors of my memory palace, but when we were talking earlier and we were talking about the use of these terms in social spaces for close friends and just people who are distant. And I was thinking about size as well, because when I imagine I'm particularly good friends with a European robin in my garden who is yay big, and obviously my friends who are human are somewhat larger. But when I envision these beings in my mind, they're all the same size. You don't. Yeah, and I wonder how much of that, the size of someone in your sort of like mental space, how much that is also an index of mattering or an index of intimacy and proximity. So I wonder how, I wonder whether size is also, I mean, you say a great friend, don't you? Or
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, no, that's these are really good points. So, I would say like mass, for example,
Yeah, weight.
weight,
Yeah,
yeah.
a weighty
So,
idea that you're
for
very,
sure.
and superficiality or lightness, you know, yeah.
Yep. Exactly. That would be another type of embodied experience. So in the essay, I primarily talk about distances and occlusions, and verticality, but I talk less about mass and weight. But indeed, there are metaphorical, there have been demonstrated to be metaphorical connotations to mass and weight, just as the ones that you just mentioned. So you have a weighty idea. If you have a weighty idea, doesn't mean the idea is heavy, right? It doesn't mean it has a higher kilogram or it doesn't mean it weighs more. It means it's more important, right? So we're using weighty metaphorically. But that is, you can imagine how that would be derived from embodied experiences with weighty things. So generally weighty things, if it's a stone, it could hurt us more, let's say. So there is a sort of meaning that's attributed to maybe heavier things in general, although certainly not by principle, but in general, to things in the world. So again, that's that mapping that happens between our physical embodied experiences and this abstract thought.
Yeah, it is. It's such a fascinating area. I just realized I've got another book by Lakoff and Johnson, Philosophy in the Flesh, and that book is just full of, you know, different examples and you know, analysis of how this works. It's, you know, for anyone who's interested in this area, that's a good book and very readable as well. So, well, to sort of whisk us back to Jung again, and you know that the idea of that particular type of house with, you know, those levels going down was obviously hugely valuable for Jung. But if you had, and at the time, you know, there was a sort of like stronger idea about, there was less of a less interest in sort of like systems thinking, for example, or network. So I was wondering if someone had a sort of like systems metaphor rather than one kind of like that was more akin to like building blocks, or then the house, you know, imagine a sort of house that kind of embodied systems or network. I mean, like you could have a door that would lead into every single other room in the house. I mean, and so if you were sort of like designing a place for, you know, some kind of you know, really innovative company at the forefront of, I don't know, tech or whatever other ideas, that sort of space where you're where you could, which almost seems to sort of like bamboozle the literal thinking of the everyday, could be very creative for people.
So the way that I would, what I would say is that there's definitely a reciprocal exchange between the things that we create in the world and the metaphors that we're able to sort of extract from those things that we create in the world for our own abstract concepts, one of them being the psyche. So if we really were sort of rigorous about Jung's articulation of the psyche in this architectural terms at this four-story house, you come to the conclusion that the only way Jung was able to invent his concept of the collective unconscious was because somebody invented a basement. And that might sound weird. That might sound weird, but it's true, right? If this dream of this house caused Jung to create this idea of the collective unconscious, then you take away that dream, or you take away that the structure of that dream, there's no collective unconscious. There's no idea of the collective unconscious, right? And so it really does force us to be aware of the objects And the elements that are around us, that surround us in our lives. So you're mentioning a couple of new sort of patterns of interaction, things that interrelate systems, artificial intelligence, what have you, all sorts of new things that we're creating, mostly digital, right? And I think it's a very, very reasonable comment to make, or very reasonable hypothesis to suggest, which is that we can also extract metaphors from these new types of technologies that we're creating. Having said that, though, I will say that I'm a bit of I really like architecture for this reason specifically, which is that when you interact with architecture, it's very embodied. It engages all of your sensory modality, all of your proprioception, all of your sort of sense of awareness, your sense of self, in a way that a lot of other technological advancements can't do, you know, be it interfacing with on a computer or interfacing on a phone or thinking about a sort of network design that's kind of just a diagram on a piece of paper or something like that. So when you're able to sort of inhabit a sort of model of you're able to inhabit a sort of more complex structure if it's articulated in the form of architecture, I find that to be a really potent way to get at these structures that you're mentioning.
So if there's a sort of like takeaway of this for I imagine that in your work there's more that's to the sense of improving the sort of like well-being within a large group of people, where there is actually sort of like large form architecture that can sort of impact people. But whether in that work or on a sort of like smaller scale, do you see ways in which the work that you're doing now could lead to more well-being, or to less or to sort of decreasing perhaps the impacts of some more negative feeling states?
I would say that the sort of the clarity, I think, with which these architectural and spatial metaphors have at producing insight for individuals, and also helping them communicate their subjectivity to other people. I think that that's a really powerful application of this work. So it almost fits then into this linguistic category. The intervention almost seems to be around language, although this is language that is helping us with mental representation. So it's also sort of a cognitive science aspect, but then there's a clinical psychology aspect, because I really do believe that this can be applied to clinical populations. This type of language can assist in therapeutic contexts. So that's one sort of application of this work. And the other application, I mean, just as I showed you some examples earlier about getting creative with our use of metaphors. So, a room of one's own, or break the glass ceiling, these new kinds of metaphors. What about where does that place architects themselves in creating new types of spaces that maybe are just so such a totally radically different sort of configuration of space, that it unlocks a whole new way of thinking about social relations, you know? And if you sort of chart the history of architecture across time, you'll find that it very much does change in correlation to changes in socio and political thought, right? And so I'm interested in that reciprocal relationship between the two. And earlier, as you mentioned, this idea of we have these new sort of network systems, network science that's coming online. How will that change our metaphors for the psyche? I believe that continually sort of innovating in architectural forms can also have the same effect for sociological thought as well. And I think that that is the challenge, the task, not an easy one, of the architects.
And what are you working on now? What's your particular area of concern before we wrap up?
Yeah, so I'm working in mental health, but in substance use and mental well-being for young people in my city in Calgary. And what we're doing is we're focusing on interventions that are upstream from clinical settings, so interventions that occur in the communities. So what we're doing is we're figuring out ways to create sort of a long-term measurement program where we're measuring substance use rates and mental well-being for youth in our city. But we're coupling that with a series of social and community programming in communities that have been proven to affect substance use rates and mental well-being in young people. So things like improving family dynamics or improving peer supports or offering more recreational and out of school activities. So this is actually, it's the Icelandic prevention model. It's a model that's imported from Iceland. They've been very successful at reducing substance use rates and improving mental health in their teenage population. So, and it's one of the few models that has actually worked. So we're trying that out in Western Canada. So that's what I'm working on right now. And again, it's sort of thinking, it's a little bit more focused on social structures rather than physical structures, the built environment, but it's very much thinking about how the context can affect these really meaningful psychological, social, and emotional variables, especially in young people.
That is incredibly valuable work. Do you expect to be sort of doing some more writing in that kind of area, perhaps, or will you continue to write in the area that you've studied?
Both, for sure, both. I'm sort of it's definitely good to have. I think that the work that I'm doing now, it has a really clear practical application. But then for somebody like me and a lot of other scholar addicts out there, it's always good to have sort of a theory portion that you're ruminating on and revisiting and those kinds of things and testing out ideas. So I will definitely keep on writing in that realm as well.
Oh, well, we'll certainly look forward to reading it.
That's
Is
good
there
news.
anything that you feel you wanted to say, or that we've missed, or do you feel that we've sort of covered as much as you'd hoped?
No, this has been a really meaningful conversation. And I just want to say too that mental well-being seems to be one of the most pertinent topics of our generation, and all sorts of new ways that we can think about the mind and think about the psyche and think about therapy. I think that these all stand to benefit us as a society in general. So I'm really looking forward to seeing where this work takes me.
That's wonderful. And good luck with all your ventures and with all your work. And thank you so much, David, for being our guest on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, Izzy.
David Borkenhagen was a fascinating guest. I had come across some of the ideas before about how our embodiment influences our cognition, but David took it further. He considers how different embodiment or different spaces could alter the way we think about time, about society, and about politics. One aspect we didn't discuss in the interview was how thinking with octopuses could encourage us to think differently about mortality. I want to read an excerpt from the article. The octopus sacrifices its own future for the future of its offspring. It becomes part of a process of intergenerational labour which required the death of its parents and will someday require the death of its children. Through its death, the octopus submits itself to this labour which it will never see completed. As a poetic interpretation, it's as if death, for the octopus, is conceptualized as less rigid. Death is not a dead end, as we imagine it, but part of a more fluid process that stretches across generations. The octopus invites us to think in a way that dissolves the boundaries between the present and the future, understanding our ending less as a fixed point and more as a fluid process stretching across generations. As the boundary between life and death dissolves and becomes more porous, so do the boundaries between ourselves and others. The metaphors we used to inhabit our time here may seem impoverished, but there's another way. It's in the unconstrained movements of an octopus travelling through space, fluid, flexible, and free. That's from the first essay we linked to in the show notes and the first one discussed in the interview. We ended up talking about Jung's houses. I wonder what sort of house you would design if you were trying to create the architecture of your psyche. Very open plan or hundreds of separate rooms? How many cellars? What would be in the attic? It's an interesting subject to meditate upon. My thanks again to David Borkenhagen and, as ever, to Dr. Dave for allowing me this opportunity.
Hi, Dr. Dave. It's Adam from Melbourne, Australia. I've been a long-time listener for over 7 years, and finally I think it's time to back up my appreciation of Shrinkwrap Radio with a donation. You provide such a wonderful, stimulating podcast, and you deserve to have this supported financially by your loyal listeners like me. And you're right, donating to Shrinkwrap Radio made me feel great, so I encourage other listeners to donate and keep supporting your unique podcast. Thanks, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Adam, there in Melbourne, Australia. I'm glad that finally making your donation made you feel good. And I can tell you it definitely made me feel good as well. Also, thank you for encouraging others to follow your fine example. Time once again to shrink wrap it up. Big thanks to Issy and her guest, David Borkenhagen, PhD, for their very stimulating discussion. I'm still working on lining up my next guest, so we'll all just have to be surprised. Until then, this is Dr. Dave reminding you to be kind to yourselves, others, and our precious Earth.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.